This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, June 14th, 2012, in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the U.S. Senate takes up a measure that would make big cuts on food assistance. It's part of a massive farm bill under review. A leaked document shows that a broad trade deal in the Pacific could expand the rights of transnational corporations to bypass domestic regulations.
It would put future climate change regulations, banking regulations, food safety regulations, you name it, virtually any public interest policy in serious jeopardy.
And we'll go to the Indian state of Assam, where a project to use mobile boat clinics is bringing vital health services to remote communities. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Egypt's Supreme Court issued a pair of shocking decisions today. In one, the court ruled to dissolve the country's democratically elected parliament on technical grounds. The other clears way for the moderate presidential candidate to run just days before the election. FSRN's Noel King is in Cairo.
The political arm of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Freedom and Justice Party, which controls nearly half of the seats in the powerful lower house of parliament, held an emergency closed-door meeting to decide on a response to the ruling. The young progressives, who form the backbone of Egypt's revolution, called the maneuver a coup by the ruling military council. Egypt's ruling generals also dissolved the 100-member committee that was set to write the country's new constitution and said they will choose a new committee. In another ruling, the court struck down the so-called political exclusion law, which sought to ban members of former President Hosni Mubarak's regime from running for office for the next decade. The ruling most directly impacted Ahmed Shafiq, Mubarak's former prime minister, who has positioned himself as the law and order candidate. He has appealed to a broad segment of Egyptian society that is deeply unsettled by ongoing street clashes and economic instability. Shafiq held a triumphant news conference following the ruling. This clears the way for Shafiq's weekend face-off against Mohamed Morsi, a stolid but charmless candidate of the Muslim Brotherhood. As dusk fell, small groups of Egyptians gathered in Tahrir Square to protest the ruling. It is unclear how the court's decisions will affect the presidential election. Noel King, FSRN, Cairo.
The Egyptian court rulings come a day after the justice minister reinstated the right of the military to arrest civilians. That power briefly went away when emergency rules expired at the end of May. The Justice Ministry said the rule will be in place until a new constitution is approved. A lawyer told the AP this amounts to a declaration of martial law. Military arrests of civilians was a hallmark of the rule of former President Hosni Mubarak. Campaigning for July parliamentary elections in Senegal began this week, and already accusations are flying between the country's two largest political parties. The former ruling Senegalese Democratic Party is angry over corruption charges and the seizure of several of their vehicles by the government. For FSRN, Alpha Jallo reports from Dakar.
About 24 political parties and coalitions have qualified for the July 4th parliamentary election ballot. 150 seats are up for grabs, and the polls will be a big test for President Macky Sall and his coalition Beno Bokyakar. However, there has been a talk of war between President Sall and former head of state Abdoulaye Wade, who famously sparked mass protests when he announced his intention to run for a third time presidential term earlier this year. He lost to Sall in the election. Now, while Senegalese Democratic Party is criticizing the government over newly launched corruption probes, Wade has threatened to disrupt parliamentary election if his party members continue to be harassed and intimidated. However, a planned demonstration by Wade and his allies in Dakar Wednesday was called off with no reason given by organizers. Alpha Jallo, Free Speech Radio News, Dakar, Senegal.
For the third day, thousands of protesters in the West African country of Togo clashed with police in the capital city. The BBC reports residents are denouncing recent electoral reforms that favor the ruling government. The same family has ruled the small country since 1967. More than 100 people have been wounded. Today, a suicide bomb claimed the lives of 10 people in the Syrian capital, Damascus, damaging a Shiite shrine located next to a police station. No one has claimed responsibility. Government forces shelled Dar el-Zor today, killing at least 11, according to Reuters. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, an NGO based in London, now estimates more than 14,000 people, including civilians, rebels, and government security forces, have died since protests began in March 2011. Another journalist has been murdered in the Mexican city of Veracruz, recognized as one of the most dangerous places in the world for reporters. FSRN's Shannon Young reports.
Crime reporter Victor Baez was found dead this morning on a street just two blocks from the government palace in Jalapa, the state capital of Veracruz. Baez was abducted last night while leaving his office. The murder is the fifth involving a reporter in less than 2 months in Veracruz. In the wake of crimes against the press, the state government often issues statements condemning the violence, but rarely follows up with concrete actions, like investigations. The murder in Veracruz comes less than 1 week after Stephanie Cardoso, a crime reporter in the state of Coahuila, was abducted from her home along with her two-year-old son. Their whereabouts remain unknown. The reporters most often targeted by violence in Mexico cover regional crime beats. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Washington, the U.S. Senate is set to begin debating the nearly $1 trillion farm bill. But before taking up the massive legislation, lawmakers must first wade through more than 200 amendments dealing with everything from sugar subsidies to rural broadband access to foreign aid to Pakistan. One current battle pits powerful crop insurance companies against defenders of the food stamp program. More than 22 million U.S. families depend on food stamps to meet their nutritional needs, but proposed cuts in the House and Senate versions of the bill have put that assistance in jeopardy. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Dependence on food stamps spiked following the 2008 recession, with one in seven U.S. residents currently receiving federal food assistance. And an April study by the Congressional Budget Office projects rising demand through at least 2014. Yet the House of Representatives passed a measure in May that cuts nearly $170 billion from the food stamp program over the next 10 years. The version soon to hit the Senate floor would cut $4.5 billion over 10 years, but a handful of Senate Democrats introduced an amendment last week to restore the funding. New Jersey Democrat Frank Lautenberg told FSRN there are better ways to save taxpayer money.
I think it's an outrage that here in a moment when there in one part of our society, there's such abundance. And here we are trying to penalize the poor. So we're going to fight the fight.
The amendment would preserve food stamp funding by reducing federal payments to crop insurance companies. Addressing the Senate on Wednesday, Kirsten Gillibrand of New York said it's a question of priorities.
Subsidies for large corporations that don't need it? Companies based in Bermuda, Australia, Switzerland? It's not the right priority for America. We should be helping the most needy among us, our children, our seniors, our family at risk.
As the farm bill debate drags on, senators on both sides of the aisle are also taking aim at the crop insurance program. New Hampshire Democrat Jean Shaheen told reporters Thursday her amendment to limit federal insurance subsidies would only affect the largest and most profitable farms, while still preserving assistance for smaller operations.
It would put a cap on insurance subsidies to large farms, farms that are often owned by corporations and that don't need the help. I believe we do need a farm safety net. I think there's no question about that. But not all farms need that level of support from the taxpayers.
As farmers across the country struggle with unprecedented droughts, floods, tornadoes, and other natural disasters, and global food prices remain sky high, crop insurance is more expensive than ever. The CBO estimates the program will cost nearly $95 billion over the next decade if no amendments to the Farm Bill's crop insurance provisions are approved. And some conservation advocates, including Scott Faber with the Environmental Working Group, say the current system of limitless subsidies encourages bad environmental practices.
The real effect of crop insurance subsidies on the environment is that it makes it economically possible to farm in places where farmers normally wouldn't farm. Wetlands, grasslands, they'll plow up forests, they'll plow up orchard crops, because they're essentially guaranteed to get at least the cost of production plus some profit back into their pocket. Because the insurance has taken, these insurance subsidies have largely taken the risk out of the equation.
Faber also opposes an amendment by Oklahoma Republican Tom Coburn to eliminate the Rural Energy in America program. The $100 million program currently assists farmers in all 50 states to transition to renewable energy. The Senate will debate and vote on these and dozens of other amendments over the next week before bringing the nearly $1 trillion bill to the floor. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
A leaked document from secret negotiations of a wide-ranging trade deal in the Pacific shows that countries are considering terms that would allow transnational corporations special authority to challenge countries' laws in the event of a dispute. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, known as TPP, could become the largest in the world, affecting protections for the environment, labor rights, access to medicine in poor countries, and jobs in the U.S. It covers trade among the U.S., Australia, Brunei, Chile, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, Malaysia, Vietnam. More countries could still join. Some groups have criticized the lack of public input and the secrecy of the talks, but the leaked text provides some details as to what world leaders are deciding. It was made public Wednesday by the watchdog group Citizens Trade Campaign. For more, we're joined by Arthur Stamoulis, executive director of Citizens Trade Campaign. He joins us by mobile phone from Portland, Oregon. Welcome to FSRN.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Your group notes that these negotiations have worked their way through 26 different aspects or chapters of this trade deal. Talk about what this leaked document lays out for how domestic governments could regulate foreign companies or multinational corporations that are operating within their borders.
Sure. So what we did yesterday was publish the leaked text of one of those 26 chapters, the chapter covering investor rights. And what those leaked texts reveal is that the United States is pushing to grant transnational corporations the power to circumvent domestic judicial systems, the court systems, and challenge virtually any new law, regulation, or even court decision that negatively affects their expectation of profits through a system of private tribunals. So if this moves forward, it would do three things. First of all, it would create what is essentially a two-track legal system, giving special rights to transnational corporations that ordinary citizens and, you know, domestic business owners do not enjoy. Second, it would put future climate change regulations, banking regulations, food safety regulations, you name it, virtually any public interest policy in serious jeopardy of being challenged through the system. And third, it would also create another incentive for U.S. corporations to offshore jobs. So this is a corporate power grab through and through, and we're hoping that the public release of these texts will get the public's attention and hopefully get our elected officials' attention as well.
So let's take a hypothetical to see how something like this could play out. Say a corporation decides to operate in Vietnam, which is a signatory to this agreement. If the government of Vietnam or a public NGO organization in Vietnam wants to challenge alleged pollution or environmental damage or labor violations, what would it do?
They would have no standing whatsoever. The public nonprofit workers, environmental groups, they don't have standing. Well, the only way that these tribunals could be used was if the government imposed new environmental regulations or new workplace safety regulations, and then the corporation decided, well, hey, if you're going to do that, you need to compensate us for it. It's essentially a regulatory takings case. It's a case that would be laughed out of the U.S. judicial system and, frankly, most other court systems throughout the world, but would be considered very seriously in these private tribunals that the TPP is trying to create.
Mm-hmm. So in that situation, as you say the government of Vietnam would have standing in an appeals court like this, but a corporation would as well.
Yeah, you know, so folks may be familiar with the World Trade Organization, the WTO. Under that system, individual countries are allowed to challenge other countries' policies that they view as a barrier to trade. The TPP, according to the leaked documents that just came out yesterday, would actually grant individual corporations the power to do that. That's a power that, you know, obviously you and I as citizens, you know, and residents of countries we don't have. It's a power that, you know, domestic small businesses, medium-sized businesses don't have. It's only a power granted to transnational corporations that are investing cross-border, and it's a big, big problem.
And just quickly, the next round of negotiations, the 13th major round, will be held at the Hilton San Diego Bayfront Hotel from July 2nd to 10th. What's next in this process?
That's right. So San Diegans and people throughout Southern California are meeting today, tomorrow, throughout the coming weeks to plan a series of educational events, demonstrations, protests. So we're going to be out there dragging the TPP out of the shadows. And if people want to learn more about that, they can visit the website stoptpp.org or visit our website, citizenstrade.org.
Arthur Stomoulis is Executive Director of Citizens Trade Campaign. He joined us to discuss the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
What are the stories that you remember when you're listening to the radio? What kinds of things stay with you and make you care about an issue or a country where you've never stepped foot? Is it a network host that yells at you? Is it a pundit or a politician spouting the party line? At FSRN, we think it's the people that matter. Everyday voices that tell their own stories in their own words.
They assume not human, like human beings. They assume just like animals. I don't know.
Manele appa appa kuritare avar dina kashta madidra.
Trabajo en casa, vivo en Moreno. Todos los días viajo.
We've had to put aside some of our planning in order just to survive.
It's these stories and voices that inspire us. Everyday voices. They're what FSRN is all about. They're what distinguishes us from the rest. They're what would be lost if FSRN is silenced. Hear more of these voices and support grassroots radio journalism on our website, fsrn.org.
This week, the United Nations released its annual report on children in armed conflict, finding that an increase in conflict in countries such as Syria, Libya, and Sudan is placing a heavy toll on children. The report also found more than 50 parties across the globe that violate human rights by recruiting and arming children or attacking schools and hospitals. In Afghanistan and Pakistan, children continue to be recruited and used for suicide attacks. And in Uganda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the Lord Resistance Army, or LRA, abducted more than 600 child soldiers and sex slaves over the past 2 years. The Ugandan rebel and founder of the group, Joseph Kony, is wanted by the International Criminal Court and remains the subject of a military hunt in the region assisted by U.S. Special Forces. One of those former child soldiers is Grace Akalo, who was abducted from her school by the LRA in 1996. She managed to escape 7 months later. FSRN's Salim Rizvi spoke with Grace Akalo at the UN in New York.
So Grace Akalo, how did it all start? How were you kidnapped?
I went to a very beautiful school. We were dancing, we were eating, and it was like Independence Day, everybody else. And the LRA came and broke into our dormitory and abducted 139 girls and moved with us out of the school into the bush. 30 of us were taken. And from there, we started moving from place to place with the rebels. And after that, we were separated in two groups. And first group were taken to Sudan, and I was the first one among the first group to go to Sudan.
What kind of training were you given? You were basically child soldiers, and you were supposed to be in the front,
yes,
as you say.
Well, it is strange that for us, from my school, Aboke Girls, we were only taught how to dismantle, clean, and assemble the gun. And they told us that hunger will teach us how to shoot. And they say that we knew how to use the gun already because we are from school, which we do not. Never in my life had I touched a gun, because in Uganda, it's illegal to own a gun. And I'd never touched a gun or even been near the gun.
After you got the training, so then you were sent to the front or for the protection of the leaders, or how did it work?
Protection of the leaders, robbing of the civilians, getting their food, because to get the civilian food, you have to pass through the SPLA first, the Sudan People's Liberation Army. So we had to fight them first, and then and if we defeat them, then we can get the food. And the people from Sudan, southern Sudan also, it looked like most of them had guns. Like, none of them seemed to be free without, you know, without a gun. So if you're going to get somebody's food, you must fight them first before you get the food.
So at that time, what was going through your mind?
I had tried to kill myself several times. I had given up. I didn't care what would happen to me, because I tried to escape, and I'd seen people killed, brutally killed in front of me who had tried to escape. I'd been forced to kill people who had tried to escape. So escape actually became really non-existent in my mind, because it was dangerous. And also, when we were taken to Sudan, it was a greater risk to escape from Sudan, because if you, the LRA would catch you, or the northern government soldiers would catch you, or the SPLA themselves would catch you, or the civilians would catch you. So it was like a greater risk to escape. There was nothing that anybody could do.
And how did you escape?
The Ugandan government and the SPLA combined together went into southern Sudan and attacked the northern government camps there, the soldiers' camps, and then entered into ours and attacked ours. And I ran away. I wouldn't say I was really, I planned to escape, no, because that was difficult. I just ran away, running away from the fight, and I ended up running away, and the SPLA rescued me and handed me over to the Ugandan soldiers. And that's how I came, I returned home.
The reintegration is not properly done, you feel that way, isn't it?
Yes, because it cannot be done in one day. It cannot be, the rehabilitation and reintegration should be holistic, should be a psychological reintegration, economical reintegration, and social reintegration. Because if that is not done, it's not going to be, it's a half-baked, I would say that. If only they're cancelled for one day and sent to reintegrate in the community, it's not possible. And also, the community itself needs to be rehabilitated, because the community has suffered. And for them to accept the kids back, to accept these children back, they need to be educated, they need to be, given social services. They need really to be able to accept the children. Reconciliation is very important.
That's Grace Akalo, a former child soldier who was abducted in Uganda, speaking with FSRN's Salim Rizvi in New York. In India's northeast state of Assam, a higher rate of women die because of complications from pregnancy and childbirth than in any other area in the country. One of the reasons is lack of medical infrastructure. More than 3 million people in Assam live on islands on the Brahmaputra River, which flows across the state, and it makes it difficult to access vital health care. But a program that uses boat clinics is reaching local residents. For many, it's the only means of access to health care. FSRN's Gayatri Parameswaran and Felix Gayetka file this report.
At 7 a.m., the Brahmaputra River in Upper Assam is full of early morning traffic. Dozens of boats are ferrying people from the islands to the land for their day's work. But one boat is different from the others. Filled with medicine, vaccines, and medical equipment, it serves as a clinic. Staff include a pharmacist, a lab technician, and three nurses. The doctor on duty today is Ritesh Kalwar.
Today we are going to Amarpur area. There we'll visit a couple of villages to set up medical camps. We have to travel quite a lot today. We've already traveled an hour on the jeep. And now there's a three-hour boat journey, and then we have to travel 5 to 6 miles on the tractor to reach one village.
These floating clinics are the brainchild of Sanjoy Hazarika, who founded an NGO called the Center for Northeast Studies and Policy Research.
I heard the story of how a young woman who was
heavily pregnant. She died while waiting for transport to a hospital on the other side of the river. And I said to myself that this is really unacceptable in this day and age, that people have to die for lack of care. So I thought, instead of people going for the service, why not take the service to them?
The boat clinics began functioning in 2005. Today, they give medical help to islanders in 13 districts across Assam with help from the government's National Rural Health Mission. For people living on remote island villages, boat clinics are the only form of health care. Back to the medical team. They've reached Napun village after 4 hours of travel. Over 100 patients, mainly women and children, have already gathered at a school classroom where the medical camp will be set up. The patients start lining up to see the doctor. Nainmani Sukram, a tribal woman, is one of them. She's in the 8th month of pregnancy.
There are no doctors in this area, so we have to come here for our checkups. The last time I came, they did a urine test for me and said I am pregnant. Now I am here to find out when I'm going to have the baby. When I had my first baby, it was very difficult. I was in labor for 4 days. I am scared what will happen this time around.
Sukram's fears are valid. Assam has the highest maternal mortality rate in the country. 390 out of 100,000 women die in childbirth. It's Nainmuni's turn to be seen. Dr. Kalwa carries out a regular antenatal checkup. He finds that her hemoglobin levels are low and prescribes her iron tablets. He stresses that she should go for an institutional delivery. After 3 hours, the camp concludes and the medics return on the boat to leave for home. Dr. Kalwar ran checkups for 110 patients today.
The main challenge with the patients is that they are not willing to take medication. They have some myths. They still believe in quacks and say that they will only take the medicines we prescribe along with some traditional herbs. But our job is to try and be patient with them and make them aware of the benefits of medicine.
The boat clinics are facing another formidable hurdle, climate change. The Brahmaputra is growing wider and shallower every year. Due to the drop in water levels, the boats are finding it more and more difficult to reach the islands. Murari Yadav is the captain of our boat today. As he navigates his boat back, he tells us that he has been sailing on the river since he was a teenager.
I can remember from long ago, from the year 1988, there has always been less and less water on the river. The water in the river has never seen such depth since those days. Now the river is very wide, and the water levels are going down every year. We used to be fearful of the current in the river in those days, but now we just hope that it rains enough so that we can plow our boats through.
But these environmental changes aren't only affecting the boat clinic's access to the islands. According to the Water Resources Department, the widening of the Brahmaputra River has eaten away 2,500 villages so far. With Felix Ketka, this is Gayatri Parmeshwaran, FSRN, Assam.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Washington, D.C. intern is Neth Smith-Savadoff. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.